thing about the photoelectric effect was that the color of the light involved seems to matter. If the light was too far toward the red end of the spectrum, then no matter how bright the light was, no current was seen. Einstein accounted for this strange behavior by proposing light was composed of a totally new particle, the photon. This was an audacious hypothesis that not only flew in the face of Machian philosophy, but also seemingly contradicted a century of experimental evidence that light was a wave, not a particle. Einstein certainly knew that light was an electromagnetic wave. The idea was crucial inspiration for his theory of relativity, but was nonetheless proposing that light was somehow also a particle, or had some kind of particle-like nature. In defense of this strange idea, Einstein could only point to the photoelectric effect itself, along with a strange quirk of the black body radiation law discovered by German physicist Max Planck 5 years earlier. For nearly 2 decades, almost nobody other than Einstein believed in photons. Even Planck himself didn't think his work suggested that light was made of particles, though years later Planck's work was hailed as the start of the quantum revolution. Only when Arthur Compton actually caught photons in the act of bouncing off of electrons in 1923 did the physics community finally come around to Einstein's way of thinking. And even then, there were a few holdouts. But Einstein was accustomed to isolation. He had changed the world in 1905, working alone in a Swiss patent office, and continued that habit for the rest of his life. Einstein once said he went through life as a one-horse cart. He rarely collaborated with other physicists, and almost never took on students of his own. He was eternally suspicious of the status quo, both scientifically and elsewhere. He characterized common sense as the collection of prejudices accumulated by the age of 18. So when Heisenberg's astonishing new theory arrived on the scene in 1925, Einstein was unsurprisingly skeptical. "Heisenberg has laid a big quantum egg," he wrote to his friend Paul Ehrenfest, shortly after Heisenberg's ideas were first published. "In Göttingen, they believe in it. I don't." Presented with the opportunity to interrogate Heisenberg at close quarters, Einstein pounced. Safely ensconced in his apartment, Einstein finally asked Heisenberg what he really wanted to know. "You assume the existence of electrons inside the atom, and you are probably quite right to do so. But you refuse to consider their orbits. I should very much like to hear more about your reasons for making such strange assumptions." "We cannot observe electron orbits inside the atom," replied Heisenberg. He pointed out that only the spectrum of light from an atom is really observable, and concluded with a rather Machian statement, "Since a good theory must be based on directly observable magnitudes, I thought it more fitting to restrict myself to these." In Heisenberg's later retelling of this encounter, Einstein was shocked at this. "But you don't seriously believe that none but observable magnitudes must go into a physical theory?" "Isn't that precisely what you have done with relativity?" replied Heisenberg. "Possibly I did use this kind of reasoning, but it is nonsense all the same," said Einstein. "On principle, it is quite wrong to try founding a theory on observable magnitudes alone. In reality, the very opposite happens. It is the theory which describes what we can observe." Einstein then went on to explain that the information about the world around us that we receive from scientific instruments, or even from our own senses, would be totally incomprehensible without some kind of theory about the way the world works. When you use a thermometer to test the temperature of a chicken you've cooked in the oven, you are assuming the thermometer accurately indicates the temperature inside of the chicken, and that the light that reflected off of the thermometer and entered your eyes accurately indicates the reading of the thermometer. In other words, you have a theory about how the world works, and you're using that, very well justified, theory to inform your use of the thermometer. Similarly, Einstein pointed out to Heisenberg that, when looking at the spectrum of an atom, you quite obviously assume that the whole mechanism of light transmission from the vibrating atom to the spectroscope or to the eye works just as one has always supposed it does. Heisenberg was completely taken aback by Einstein's attitude, as he recalled later. Falling back on the seemingly solid ground of Mach's philosophy, Heisenberg replied, "The idea that a good theory is no more than a condensation of observations surely goes back to Mach, and it has, in fact, been said that your relativity theory makes decisive use of Machian concepts. But what you have just told me seems to indicate the very opposite. What am I to make of all this? Or rather, what do you yourself think about it?" Mach rather neglects the fact that the world really exists, that our sense impressions are based on something objective, Einstein replied. He pretends that we know perfectly well what the word observe means, and that this exempts him from having to discriminate between objective and subjective phenomena. I have a strong suspicion that, precisely because of the problems we have just been discussing, your theory will one day get you into hot water. With the two men seemingly at an impasse, Heisenberg decided to change the subject. For several days he had been struggling with a difficult professional decision. Heisenberg had spent 7 productive months working with Bohr in Copenhagen a year earlier, shortly before his fateful trip to Heligoland. Now, Bohr had offered Heisenberg an opportunity to come to Copenhagen again, this time as Bohr's assistant. Heisenberg, naturally, had jumped at the opportunity, but a few days later he found himself in an incredibly fortunate dilemma. Heisenberg had been offered a tenured professorship in Leipzig, a permanent and prestigious position, and unheard of for someone so young. Unsure of what to do, he asked Einstein's advice. Einstein told him to go work with Bohr. 3 days later, Heisenberg was on his way to Copenhagen to once again sit at the feet of the quantum master himself. Bohr and Einstein were friends. After their first meeting in 1920, Einstein wrote to Bohr that, "Seldom in my life has a person given me such pleasure by his mere presence as you have." Writing to his close friend, Paul Ehrenfest, Einstein said Bohr is like a sensitive child and walks about this world in a kind of hypnosis. Both Einstein and Bohr were great physicists of the same generation, and each had an enormous impact on the development of quantum physics. But the similarity mostly ends there. Unlike Einstein, Bohr continually worked with other physicists. Over the course of nearly half a century, Bohr took dozens of young physicists under his wing, mentoring them not only in physics, but in all aspects of life. His enormous charisma and force of personality left a huge impression on all visitors to his institute in Copenhagen. "Even to the big shots, Bohr was the great god," as Richard Feynman, the American physicist, put it. To students and younger colleagues, Bohr was a father figure and sage of superhuman wisdom who was the wisest of living men, according to the American physicist David Frisch. John Wheeler, one of Bohr's most illustrious and influential students, compared Bohr's wisdom to Confucius and Buddha, Jesus and Pericles, Erasmus and Lincoln. And to many of Bohr's colleagues, he was a near mystical figure, a font of unalloyed scientific truth. "We all look up to you as the profoundest thinker in science," wrote the English chemist Frederick Donnan in a letter to Bohr. "The heaven-sent expounder of the real meaning of these modern advances, I can and will think of you walking in your beautiful gardens and stealing some moments of peace whilst the leaves and the flowers and the birds whisper their secrets to you." Bohr's remarkable charisma was enhanced by his immense institutional power. The Danish government created and funded a research institute with the sole purpose of giving Bohr an environment to work in. The Danish Academy of Arts and Sciences chose Bohr to be the resident of the Carlsberg House of Honor, built and funded by the Carlsberg Corporation, the great Danish beer-brewing company. the scion of a leading Danish intellectual family, Bohr regularly entertained at his home not only physicists, but artists, politicians, and even the Danish royal family. For the young physicists who came to Copenhagen, Bohr could provide intellectual stimulation and help in advancing careers, spiritual fulfillment and down-to-earth fun, material benefits, and psychological counsel, as the historian of science Mara Beller put it. He became a father figure who many young scientists were eager to honor and whose authority not many dared to challenge. Indeed, Bohr's influence on his students' lives often went well beyond the professional into the most intensely personal. According to Victor Weisskopf, one of Bohr's most brilliant students, any physicist working with Bohr was certain to be married after no more than 2 years. Visiting the great sage of Copenhagen was intellectually and emotionally overwhelming, especially for young scientists. Bohr had invited a number of us out to Carlsberg, where, sipping our coffee after dinner, we sat close to him, some literally at his feet, on the floor, so as not to miss a word, wrote Otto Frisch, another of Bohr's students. Here, I felt, was Socrates come to life again, tossing us challenges in his gentle way, lifting each argument onto a higher plane, drawing wisdom out of us which we didn't know was in us, and which, of course, wasn't. Our conversations ranged from religion to genetics, from politics to art, and when I cycled home through the streets of Copenhagen, fragrant with lilac or wet with rain, I felt intoxicated with the heady spirit of Platonic dialogue. But Bohr was a peculiar kind of sage, brilliant and insightful, yet plodding and obscure, sometimes infuriatingly so. It is practically impossible to describe Niels Bohr to a person who has never worked with him, said George Gemov, a Russian physicist and former student of Bohr, who had a famously large personality himself. Probably his most characteristic property was the slowness of his thinking and comprehension. Gemov then described the frustration that was watching a movie with the father of quantum physics. The only movies Bohr liked were those called The Gunfight at the Lazy G Ranch or The Lone Ranger and a Sioux Girl. But it was hard to go with Bohr to the movies. He could not follow the plot and was constantly asking us, to the great annoyance of the rest of the audience, questions like this. Is that the sister of that cowboy who shot the Indian who tried to steal a herd of cattle belonging to her brother-in-law? The same slowness of reaction was apparent at scientific meetings. Many a time, a visiting young physicist, most physicists visiting Copenhagen were young, would deliver a brilliant talk about his recent calculations on some intricate problem of the quantum theory. Everybody in the audience would understand the argument quite clearly, but Bohr wouldn't. So everybody would start to explain to Bohr the simple point he had missed, and in the resulting turmoil, everybody would stop understanding anything. Finally, after a considerable period of time, Bohr would begin to understand, and it would turn out that what he understood about the problem presented by the visitor was quite different from what the visitor meant, and was correct, while the visitor's interpretation was wrong. For his students and colleagues, the pull of Bohr's reputation and his sheer force of personality overcame the annoyances and peculiarities of working with him. If anything, those peculiarities endeared Bohr to his students more, for Bohr's quirks allowed them to see that it was not simply that they needed Bohr, he also needed them. Bohr's working style was slow, intense, and collaborative by nature. He was constantly wording and rewording his ideas and bouncing them off others. Writing was a painful process for Bohr, and nearly impossible for him to accomplish without help. In fact, in the years encompassing the crucial infancy of quantum theory, from 1922 to 1930, Bohr did not publish a single paper alone. And where Einstein's writing was clear and deceptively simple, Bohr's writing was torturous and obscure, with famously long and convoluted sentences. Here, for example, is one of his shorter and more straightforward sentences, in which he is explaining that quantum jumps are the key difference between quantum physics and Newton's classical physics. Notwithstanding the difficulties which, hence, are involved in the formulation of the quantum theory, it seems, as we shall see, that its essence may be expressed in the so-called quantum postulate, which attributes to any atomic process an essential discontinuity, or rather individuality, completely foreign to the classical theories and symbolized by Planck's quantum of action. Bohr was no more clear in speech than in writing. At a 1932 conference, Bohr gave a fundamental report on the current difficulties of atomic theory, recalled his student, Carl von Weizsäcker. With an expression of suffering, his head held to one side, he stumbled over incomplete sentences, and Bohr's difficulties with expressing himself weren't limited to public talks. Describing a private conversation, Weizsäcker wrote that Bohr's stumbling way of talking would become less and less intelligible the more important the subject became. Strangely, Bohr purportedly told his students to never express yourself more clearly than you are able to think. Yet this obscurity of thought merely added to Bohr's sage-like qualities. He could say a single word and leave his students puzzling over it for hours or days on end, and his obscurity did not diminish his students' feelings for him. Rudolf Peierls, one of Bohr's students, who later supervised the Ph.D. of a young John Bell, said that, although often we could not understand Bohr, we admired him almost without reservation and loved him without limits. 3 days after leaving Einstein in Berlin, Heisenberg arrived in Copenhagen. Since his previous stint at Bohr's Institute, he had successfully defended his Ph.D., developed matrix mechanics, and been offered a faculty position. But rather than returning victorious, Heisenberg was frustrated. His matrix mechanics was revolutionary, but his triumph had been short-lived. 6 months after Heisenberg's work had first appeared in print, the Viennese physicist, Erwin Schrödinger, published a competing theory of quantum physics, wave mechanics. Schrödinger had come up with wave mechanics while shacked up with his mistress in a resort in the Swiss Alps in December 1925. His theory was written in the relatively simple mathematical language of waves, with smoothly changing wave functions governed by the Schrödinger equation, as we saw in Chapter 1. Heisenberg was worried that Schrödinger's accomplishment would eclipse his own, and rightly so. The abstruse mathematics of Heisenberg's matrix mechanics was unfamiliar to most physicists at the time, and it had no obvious picture of the world to go along with it. Schrödinger's theory, meanwhile, used familiar mathematics with simple physical ideas. It was easy to handle and easy to think about. Schrödinger boasted that with his theory, physicists didn't have to suppress intuition and to operate only with abstract concepts, such as transition probabilities, energy levels, and the like. Much of the physics community agreed, even Heisenberg's erstwhile allies. Arnold Sommerfeld, Heisenberg's Ph.D. advisor, said, "Although the truth of matrix mechanics is indubitable, its handling is extremely intricate and frighteningly abstract. Schrödinger has now come to our rescue." Born described Schrödinger's wave mechanics as the deepest form of the quantum laws. Pauli, meanwhile, used Schrödinger's theory to do what he had been unable to accomplish with matrix mechanics alone. He managed to derive the brightness of the spectral lines in hydrogen, solving a problem that had been outstanding for more than 70 years. Yet, for all the successes of wave mechanics, and for all Schrödinger's bluster, it seemed that in the areas they overlapped, Schrödinger's wave mechanics gave the same results as Heisenberg's matrix mechanics. Schrödinger's theory, like Heisenberg's, reproduced the spectrum of the hydrogen atom perfectly. The different energy levels of Bohr's atoms were, in Schrödinger's theory, associated with energy eigenstates, special wave functions with constant energies. As Schrödinger soon discovered, matrix mechanics and wave mechanics were mathematically equivalent, using different tools to describe the same ideas. a single new theory of quantum mechanics. Problems like the brightness of spectral lines had been solved first with wave mechanics only because Schrödinger's equation was mathematically easier to handle than Heisenberg's matrices in most situations. But the two versions of quantum mechanics still differed radically in their interpretation. Schrödinger was sure that he could find a way to interpret all quantum phenomena as the smooth movement of the waves his equation described. Heisenberg was unconvinced. The more I think about the physical portion of the Schrödinger theory, the more repulsive I find it, he wrote to Pauli. What Schrödinger writes about the visualization of his theory is probably not quite right. In other words, it's crap. Yet Schrödinger's waves seemed more natural to most physicists than Heisenberg's matrices. Heisenberg, frustrated by the situation and fearful that Schrödinger's ideas would eclipse his own, wrote to his mentor, Bohr. Bohr, in turn, wrote to Schrödinger, inviting him to visit Copenhagen to have some discussions for the narrower circle of those who work here at the Institute, in which we can deal more deeply with the open questions of atomic theory. Schrödinger arrived by train on the 1st of October, 1926, and the debate started immediately, as Heisenberg later recalled. Bohr's discussions with Schrödinger began at the railway station and were continued daily from early morning until late at night. Schrödinger stayed in Bohr's house so that nothing would interrupt the conversations, and although Bohr was normally most considerate and friendly in his dealings with people, he now struck me as an almost remorseless fanatic, one who was not prepared to make the least concession or grant that he could ever be mistaken. It is hardly possible to convey just how passionate the discussions were, just how deeply rooted the convictions of each, a fact that marked their every utterance. Schrödinger believed that his wave equation's success meant that all quantum phenomena could eventually be explained away as the behavior of continuous waves. Yet Bohr and Heisenberg pointed out that there were phenomena that seemed to demand quantum jumps, like electrons jumping from one orbit to another in Bohr's atom, which could not be explained away by the smooth movement of waves. Schrödinger disagreed. If all this damned quantum jumping were really here to stay, I should be sorry I ever got involved with quantum theory, he complained. Eventually, Schrödinger, worn out by Bohr's relentless questioning, caught a feverish cold in the damp, dark Danish autumn, and took to his bed in the Bohr's house. While Margrethe, Bohr's wife, brought Schrödinger tea and cake, Bohr's continued to press his advantage, sitting on the edge of Schrödinger's bed and saying in his quiet voice, "But you must surely admit that..." With neither side convinced by the other, Schrödinger went home. No understanding could be expected, since at the time, neither side was able to offer a complete and coherent interpretation of quantum mechanics, Heisenberg recalled. For all that, we in Copenhagen felt convinced toward the end of Schrödinger's visit that we were on the right track. Fundamentally, the problem was that the meaning of Schrödinger's wave function was still not clear. But Max Born had discovered a piece of the puzzle that summer. He found that a particle's wave function in a location yields the probability of measuring the particle in that location, and that the wave function collapses once measurement happens. Born's insight ultimately won him a Nobel Prize, and rightly so. But Born's rule for handling wave functions also left physicists with new puzzles. What was a measurement? And why did wave functions behave differently when they were being measured, whatever that might mean? Born's idea and Schrödinger's mathematics had unlocked the quantum world. But at a price. The measurement problem had arrived. Heisenberg wasn't particularly concerned with solving the measurement problem. He was more concerned with getting another offer for a tenured professorship. He was worried that Schrödinger's accomplishment had eclipsed his own, and that he had made a mistake in returning to Copenhagen rather than accepting the permanent professional safety that had been offered by Leipzig. Hungry for another major insight to improve his chances on the job market and to one-up Schrödinger, Heisenberg turned his attention to measurement, but not the measurement problem. Instead, he focused on something less difficult and more likely to yield results. The limitations on what we can learn about quantum objects. Combining Born's new idea with some of Einstein's suggestions from their meeting in Berlin, Heisenberg uncovered a pithy new truth that, he thought, put the lie to Schrödinger's idea of an orderly quantum world. Heisenberg started thinking about what would happen if you tried to measure the position of a single particle, like an electron, to very high precision. He realized that you could do this the same way you'd look for a lost wallet in a dark field. Shine a flashlight around until you found what you're looking for. An ordinary flashlight wouldn't work for an electron, though. The wavelength of visible light is far too large for that. But Heisenberg knew you could find an electron using higher energy light with a shorter wavelength. Gamma rays. Shine a gamma ray flashlight around the room, and you'll find your electron. But gamma rays pack a punch. Bounce one gamma ray photon off an electron, and the electron will go careening off in some random direction. So you'll know where the electron was, but you won't know how fast it's going, or where it's heading now. Heisenberg wondered if this kind of trade-off between measuring an object's position and its momentum was unavoidable, or if it was just an artifact of his thought experiment. To his delight, he discovered that these limits on measurement were fundamental, buried in the mathematics of Schrödinger's wave mechanics. Heisenberg found a precise formulation of how much information you have to give up about an object's momentum in order to learn more about its position and vice versa. You could know a lot about where an object was or a lot about how it was moving, but you couldn't know both at the same time. At Bohr's urging, Heisenberg used the term uncertainty principle to describe this insight. Heisenberg's uncertainty paper paid off as he had hoped. The University of Leipzig again offered him a tenured professorship. He accepted, and in June 1927, Heisenberg, at 25, became the youngest tenured professor in all of Germany. Meanwhile, Bohr's found that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle meshed well with his own new ideas about the true nature of the quantum world, which he called complementarity. In typical Bohr fashion, his paper on complementarity became bogged down in a series of drafts, filled with sentences that refused to end. But that September, Bohr ran out of time for rewrites. The International Physics Conference was meeting on the shores of Alpine Lake Como in northern Italy, and Bohr was scheduled to give the keynote address. Frantically revising his prepared statements up through the day of his talk, Bohr took the stage, speaking softly and haltingly. Bohr started from the idea that our usual description of physical phenomena is based entirely on the idea that the phenomena concerned may be observed without disturbing them appreciably. But as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle made clear, any observation of atomic phenomena will involve an interaction with the agency of observation not to be neglected. Therefore, Bohr continued, an independent reality in the ordinary physical sense can neither be ascribed to the phenomena nor to the agencies of observation. In other words, one could not ask what was really happening inside of an atom when nobody looked. According to Bohr, the quantum world could only be considered real in conjunction with some kind of measurement apparatus to study that world. And the behavior of the objects in that world, as indicated by such an apparatus, would be best described as either particles or waves, but never both simultaneously. These descriptions are contradictory. A particle has a definite location, which waves don't. Waves have frequencies and wavelengths which particles don't. Yet Bohr claimed that this inevitable dilemma was not a problem for quantum physics. We are not dealing with contradictory, but with complementary pictures of the phenomena, claimed Bohr, which are indispensable for a description of experience. This wave-particle duality shows up in all quantum phenomena. For example, in an old cathode ray tube TV, Electrons shoot from the back of the TV toward the phosphorescent screen at the front of the TV, which lights up when an electron hits it. When an electron is shot out into the tube, its wave function obeys the Schrödinger equation, undulating and propagating outward like a wave. But when the electron hits the phosphorescent screen, it hits in one location, lighting up a particular spot on the screen like a particle. So sometimes the electron behaves like a wave, and sometimes it behaves like a particle, but never both. According to Bohr, there cannot be a more complete description of an electron or of anything, merely incomplete and incompatible analogies that never overlap. This, Bohr said, was the heart of complementarity, and it was inevitable and unavoidable. The new quantum theory had shown it was impossible to give a single consistent account of an electron that would work at all times. Bohr pointed to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle as further justification for the inevitability of complementarity. Using Heisenberg's gamma-ray flashlight as an example, he pointed out that there was no way to avoid altering the momentum of an electron when observing its position, and vice versa. Bohr then echoed Mach, as Heisenberg had, and claimed the impossibility of measuring both properties of an electron simultaneously meant that it could not have both properties simultaneously. Position and momentum, like particles and waves, were complementary, never used at once, but both needed for the complete description of a situation. But Bohr was wrong. There was nothing inevitable or necessary about complementarity. Other interpretations of quantum physics are possible. Indeed, the claim of inevitability is an awfully strong and strange claim to make about any interpretive issue in science, precisely because it is always possible to reinterpret any theory. Yet Bohr was convinced that complementarity was the deepest insight into nature found within the quantum theory. Stranger still is Bohr's use of the gamma-ray flashlight to bolster his claims. It's certainly true that the thought experiment illustrates a world in which there are limits on our knowledge, but it's also a world where particles have well-defined positions and momenta at all times. Hitting an electron with a gamma ray can't alter the electron's momentum unless it has a momentum in the first place. We don't know what that momentum is, but that's certainly not the same thing as saying it doesn't exist. As is always the case with Bohr, it's hard to be sure what he was actually trying to say, because his writing is so convoluted and obscure. But this is certainly how complementarity has often been understood. And as far as Bohr's audience at Como, it's not clear what they understood at all. The reaction to his talk was muted. Many of the people in the audience were his students and colleagues, Heisenberg, Pauli, Born, and had spent much time in Copenhagen, listening to Bohr expound on these ideas before. Many others were simply unimpressed. "Complementarity doesn't provide you with any equations which you didn't have before," said the English physicist Paul Dirac. Dirac wasn't merely sniping, he had, in fact, discovered a new equation himself. He had skillfully fused quantum physics with special relativity, leading to a new theory of particle physics that came to be known as quantum field theory. Dirac's theory correctly predicted the existence of antimatter, a feat that would win him a Nobel Prize in 1933. Eugene Wigner, the brilliant Hungarian mathematical physicist, agreed, stating that Bohr's principle will not change the way we do physics. Schrödinger, of course, vehemently disagreed with Bohr, but Schrödinger wasn't there. He had just received a cushy appointment as a professor of physics in Berlin, and was still dealing with his move there from Switzerland. And there was nothing for Einstein to love in Bohr's ideas, but Einstein was also absent. 5 years earlier, the fascist Benito Mussolini had taken control of Italy by marching on Rome with 30,000 black shirts, and Einstein had resolved to boycott all events in Italy as long as Mussolini and his thugs were in power. But the next month, Bohr and many of the physicists at Como assembled again for a prestigious invitation-only conference in Brussels. And this time, Einstein, Schrödinger, and more besides were all there. The stage for the quantum showdown was set. 3. Street Brawl. Ernst Solvay wanted to leave his mark on the world with his money. Like Alfred Nobel before him, he had profited through industrial applications of chemistry, though less explosively than Nobel, the father of dynamite. And also, like Nobel, he wanted to better the world by promoting scientific research. So in 1911, Solvay used his money to organize a conference on the nascent quantum theory in his native Belgium. The conference was an enormous success, and Solvay decided to pour more money into organizing invitation-only conferences on subjects at the cutting edge of physics and chemistry. Solvay himself died in 1922, but his conferences continue to this day and are among the most rarefied of all scientific meetings. Yet the fifth Solvay conference, held in Brussels in October 1927, stands out from the rest. 17 of the 29 attendees had won or would go on to win Nobel Prizes. One person there, Marie Curie, already had two Nobels to her name. In addition to Curie, Einstein, Planck, Schrödinger, Bohr, Heisenberg, Born, Dirac, and Pauli were there, and the conference photograph appears in many quantum physics textbooks. And along with this picture, a historical fable has been handed down from generation to generation of physicists through an informal oral tradition, a sort of origin myth for quantum physics itself. It goes like this. Once upon a time, a group of brilliant physicists discovered quantum physics. The new theory was wildly successful, yet Einstein couldn't accept the radical new picture of nature revealed by quantum physics, despite the pivotal role he had played in its early development, and despite the fact that older physicists had similarly argued against Einstein's theory of relativity a generation earlier. Famously protesting that God does not play dice, Einstein had a series of informal debates with Bohr, beginning in Solvay in 1927, in which he repeatedly tried to find a way around Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Ultimately, Bohr prevailed, and the rest of the physics community accepted that quantum physics was correct and that the Copenhagen interpretation was the correct way to understand it. But Einstein never accepted the new theory, and until the day he died, he insisted that nature could not be fundamentally random. Thus, the fable concludes, even the greatest and most famous physicists can still be wrong. Some of this story is true. It's true that Einstein and Bohr disagreed about quantum physics. It's true that they debated it at the Solvay Conference in 1927 and afterward. And it's true that Einstein said that God does not play dice, though he said it in a letter to Max Born in 1926, not in Brussels in 1927. But in almost every other important respect, Einstein's real problem with quantum physics, Bohr's defense of it, even the content of the Copenhagen interpretation and its general acceptance by the rest of the physics community after 1927, the truth is entirely different, and far more interesting than the standard fable suggests. Louis de Broglie, physicist and French nobleman, was among the first to speak at the fifth Solvay conference. De Broglie, who had defended his PhD thesis only 3 years prior, had been the first to suggest that all of the fundamental constituents of matter had both a particle and a wave aspect. He had borrowed much of his reasoning from Einstein. His advisor, Paul Langevin, had not been sure what to make of de Broglie's ideas, so Langevin wrote to Einstein to ask his opinion. Einstein replied enthusiastically, declaring that de Broglie had lifted a corner of the Great Veil, and de Broglie got his doctorate. Speaking to the assembled conference in Brussels, de Broglie presented a new idea. Skillfully manipulating the Schrödinger equation, he developed a novel picture of quantum physics with the same mathematics. Rather than particles and waves being incomplete, contradictory, complementary pictures of the quantum, de Broglie offered a quantum world where particles and waves lived in a peaceful coexistence, with particles surfing along pilot waves that govern their motion, anticipating Bohm's interpretation of quantum physics a quarter century later. De Broglie's particles moved in an entirely deterministic way, despite Born's statistical rule identifying the wave function as a tool for calculating probabilities. Yet the particles satisfied Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, because their paths were hidden from view. No experiment could reveal a particle's full trajectory, just as Heisenberg had said. De Broglie had found a way to restore determinism and causality to the quantum world without sacrificing the extraordinary match between theory and observation of the new quantum physics. De Broglie's ideas were met with interest and vigorous debate. Wolfgang Pauli was quick to object. He claimed that de Broglie's theory contradicted existing theoretical work on particle collisions in quantum physics. De Broglie, floundering under Pauli's scrutiny, struggled to explain that Pauli was wrong. Pauli's objection was based on a deeply misleading analogy, which threw the French prince for a loop. While de Broglie's reply was largely accurate, Pauli remained unsatisfied. Another, more serious objection to de Broglie's interpretation came from Hans Kremers, a Dutch physicist who had been one of Bohr's students. He pointed out that when a photon bounces off a mirror, the mirror must recoil slightly from the impact. But de Broglie's theory, according to Kremers, could not explain the mirror's recoil. De Broglie admitted he could not answer this question. Unbeknownst to de Broglie or Kremers, it was, in fact, possible to explain the mirror's recoil using de Broglie's theory. It merely required treating both the photon and the mirror as quantum objects, not just the photon. But de Broglie, like most other physicists at the time, thought that quantum physics applied only to small objects, and this left him unable to reply to Kremers. Soon after the conference, de Broglie himself gave up on his ideas, for reasons related to Kremer's objection. Born and Heisenberg spoke next, presenting their matrix-based formulation of quantum physics, in which irreducibly random quantum jumps played a central role. Toward the end of their presentation, they boldly claimed that quantum physics was a closed theory whose fundamental physical and mathematical assumptions are no longer susceptible to any modification. In other words, quantum physics was done, fully cooked. There was no further need to dig into the innards and find something more, either mathematically or interpretationally. Later on, Bohr spoke, mostly rehashing his Como lecture, emphasizing that the wave and particle descriptions of quantum phenomena were complementary rather than contradictory, both necessary for a complete description, but never to be used to describe the same object at the same time. Finally, after several days of sitting and listening while saying almost nothing, Einstein rose to speak during a period of open discussion. He had been passing notes with his close friend, Paul Ehrenfest, gently mocking the Copenhagen camp, and had waited to carefully formulate his thoughts before he replied to them. Everyone in the room knew that Einstein had serious reservations about Bohr and Heisenberg's ideas. Now, all eyes were on him as he walked up to the chalkboard to sketch out a simple thought experiment that contained a devastating critique of the Copenhagen interpretation. Why were Bohr, Heisenberg, and others so convinced that the quantum world couldn't be visualized? Why did they seem to think that things couldn't be real until they were observed? Why did they insist that the classical world obeyed fundamentally different rules from the quantum world? Why, in short, did they believe the strange assemblage of claims that came to be known as the Copenhagen interpretation? Niels Bohr's force of personality is the most obvious answer, but the next question is why Bohr had these ideas. or even whether he did. Bohr's writing is so difficult and obscure that it is hard to say what Bohr's own positions were, which makes it even harder to divine the ideas that influenced Bohr. Amazingly, Bohr's students and colleagues cited complementarity as a reason for this. According to his students, Bohr himself had said that truth was complementary to clarity, and thus they claimed Bohr was a very bad speaker because he was too much concerned with truth. Similarly, his sentences were long, involuted, and opaque because he strove for precision. But Bohr's obfuscatory writing hasn't thwarted attempts to trace the origins of his ideas. On the contrary, there's a cottage industry of theorizing about what was happening inside the head of one Niels Henrik David Bohr. Some have suggested that he was influenced primarily by Kant. Others have pointed at his compatriot, Søren Kierkegaard, buried just a few dozen yards away from Bohr in Copenhagen's Assistens Cemetery. Still others have seen the influence of Gnosticism in the contradictions of complementarity. Bohr's most loyal and vocal advocate, Leon Rosenfeld, saw a consistent strain of Marxism in Bohr's writing and thoughts, an opinion that surely had nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that Rosenfeld himself was an avowed Marxist. In short, the literature on Bohr is vast and inconclusive, though most seem to agree that Kant's writing really did have some influence on him. Bohr's opaque writing and peculiar ability to inspire devotion in his students and colleagues aren't the whole explanation, though. Another part of the answer lies in the intellectual atmosphere of the period itself. For example, the anti-materialist culture of interwar Weimar Germany likely played a role, and Heisenberg and others were definitely influenced by Ernst Mach and his successors, the Vienna Circle, of philosophers who developed a school of thought called logical positivism. Logical positivism picked up where Mach left off. According to them, any statement that made reference to something unobservable was not only bad science, it was literally meaningless. Thus, talking about what happens in quantum systems when nobody's looking is nonsensical. The influence of the logical positivists on the founders of quantum physics was particularly personal in the case of Wolfgang Pauli. Pauli was born and raised in Vienna, and his godfather was Ernst Mach himself. Outspoken, quick-witted, and deeply talented, Pauli had enormous influence among the physicists of his day. Heisenberg and Bohr both craved his good opinion, but it was hard to come by. Pauli's scathing put-downs were legendary, earning him the nickname the Wrath of God. "I do not mind if you think slowly, but I do object when you publish more quickly than you can think," he once told a colleague. He dismissively said of another physicist's paper that it is not even wrong. Even his compliments were backhanded. After hearing Einstein lecture to a full house at the University of Munich, Pauli exclaimed, "You know, what Mr. Einstein said is not so stupid." And when discussing matters of quantum interpretation, Pauli often sounded a positivist note. According to him, worrying about the position of an object before it's been measured was pointless. "One should no more rack one's brain about the problem of whether something one cannot know anything about exists all the same," he said, "than about the ancient question of how many angels are able to sit on the point of a needle." Positivism influenced the rest of the Copenhagen camp, but to varying degrees, and they applied it in different ways, leading to inconsistent views among them. Bohr simply dismissed the idea of a quantum world altogether. "There is no quantum world," he said. "Isolated material particles are abstractions, their properties on the quantum theory being definable and observable only through their interaction with other systems." But Heisenberg thought there was a quantum world, just one that operated differently from our own. "The atoms or the elementary particles are not as real as phenomena in daily life. They form a world of potentialities or possibilities rather than one of things or facts. And Jordan thought that observations not only disturb what has to be measured, they produce it. He claimed that measuring an electron compels it to assume a definite position. But if there's no quantum world, as Bohr claimed, then measurements can't compel anything to happen there. And Pauli contradicted Bohr, too. Pauli thought that observation introduced indeterminable effects that disturbed the systems being observed in uncontrollable ways. Yet observation certainly can't disturb the quantum world if there is no quantum world, as Bohr thought. Pauli may have even contradicted himself. He had dismissed the whole enterprise of talking about what happened when nobody was looking. But if it's meaningless to talk about things before they're observed, how could Pauli say observation disturbed anything at all? And Heisenberg and Jordan clearly contradicted Pauli. They had no qualms about making strong statements about unobserved systems. Thus, the myth that these physicists created a unified Copenhagen interpretation is just that. A myth. Yet despite their differences, Bohr, Heisenberg, and the rest of the Göttingen-Copenhagen group had a few things in common. They all agreed that it was pointless to talk about what was really happening in the quantum world. Making accurate predictions about the outcomes of measurements was, for them, enough. As Bohr put it years after Solvay, "It is wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is. Physics concerns what we can say about nature." Quantum physics, then, didn't have to present a coherent or consistent picture of how the world operated. Indeed, according to Bohr's complementarity, such a picture was necessarily impossible. It was enough to merely describe measurable features of the world accurately, without talking about what was actually happening. Quantum physics, in short, shouldn't be taken seriously as a theory of the way the world actually is. Instead, quantum physics is a mere tool, an instrument for predicting the outcomes of measurements. Yet strangely, its unseriousness should be taken very seriously. In claiming their version of quantum physics as a closed theory, Heisenberg and Born were ruling out the possibility of an explanation of the quantum world independent of observation, even in principle. This is where Einstein parted ways with Bohr, Heisenberg, and their ideological compatriots. The programmatic aim of all physics, according to Einstein, was the complete description of any individual real situation as it supposedly exists, irrespective of any act of observation or substantiation. In this view, Einstein knew he was out of sync with the intellectual fashion of his day. Whenever the positivistically inclined modern physicist hears such a formulation, his reaction is that of a pitying smile. But Einstein found positivism wholly uncompelling, seeing it as a total rejection of the idea of a physical world, tantamount to claiming that reality exists only in our minds. What I dislike in this kind of argumentation is the basic positivistic attitude, which from my point of view is untenable and which seems to me to come to the same thing as Irish philosopher George Berkeley's principle, esse est percipi, to be is to be perceived. Though Einstein had no doubts about the importance of the new quantum theory, he was convinced that Born and Heisenberg were wrong to claim that quantum physics was complete, and that Bohr's philosophy of complementarity was inadequate for understanding the true nature of the quantum world. His thought experiment was simple, elegant, and carefully designed to strike at the heart of this inadequacy. "Consider," Einstein said to the assembled Solvay conference, "a stream of electrons passing through a very small hole in a screen. See figure 3.2. On the other side of the screen, there is a hemisphere of phosphorescent film that can register the impact of a single electron. According to quantum physics, the wave function for the stream of electrons should be uniform, The probability of an electron hitting the film should be the same at every location on the hemisphere. And that's fine. If quantum physics says you'll find 10 electrons per square centimeter of film after conducting your experiment, then on average, that's what you'll find. Quantum physics is great at describing the aggregate behavior of large groups of particles. But quantum physics can't do more than assign probabilities. It can't tell you exactly how many electrons will hit each part of the screen. It can only give you an average. Now, Einstein asked his audience to consider the case in which a single electron is sent through the hole. Quantum physics still predicts that the electron is equally likely to hit at any location on the screen, and cannot be more precise than that. That's fine, though. Maybe it just means the theory is incomplete or limited in some way. But, Einstein reminded the group, Heisenberg and Born had claimed that quantum physics was closed, complete, perfect as it was. In that case, there cannot be anything that determines the particular location at which the electron hits the film. But this is a problem, and not because it introduces randomness into nature. Instead, the problem is one of locality. The principle that something that happens in one location can't instantly influence an event that happens somewhere else. The wave function of our single electron is spread evenly across the hemisphere of film. And according to Heisenberg, Born, and Bohr, the electron itself isn't anywhere. The fact that the electron's wave function is evenly spread simply means that the film is equally likely to register the impact of an electron at any location. But, Einstein pointed out, what happens to the wave function when the film does register that impact in one particular spot? Born had shown that a particle's wave function was proportional to the probability of finding the particle in a particular place. But once the electron impacts the film in a particular spot, the probability of it hitting the film anywhere else immediately drops to zero. So, somehow, the wave function must instantaneously vanish across the entire hemisphere the moment that spot on the film indicates the electron hit. Anything less than instantaneous vanishing, and we run the risk of seeing a non-existent second electron register on the film after the first at some location where the wave function isn't yet zero. This entirely peculiar mechanism of action at a distance, said Einstein, implies to my mind a contradiction with the principle, that is to say, the special theory of relativity, which states very clearly that neither objects nor signals can travel faster than the speed of light. Thus, if quantum physics really is a complete description of nature, then it must violate relativity. To Einstein, the conclusion was obvious. The electron must have been in a particular location even before it hit the film, even though quantum physics could say nothing about where exactly it was. This was the only way Einstein saw to avoid invoking an instantaneous wave function collapse that would violate locality. Therefore, quantum physics was an incomplete description of nature, and more was needed to understand the true story of the quantum world. Specifically, to avoid contradictions with relativity, particles must have determinate locations at all times, in addition to wave functions. I think that Mr. de Broglie is right to search in this direction, Einstein concluded. The response to Einstein's thought experiment from the rest of the conference was muted in comprehension. Bohr, to his credit, admitted as much. I feel myself in a very difficult position because I don't understand what precisely is the point which Einstein wants to make, he said. No doubt it is my fault. Einstein's simple thought experiment offered a devastating critique of the Copenhagen position, but its simplicity may have paradoxically been a barrier to understanding. Einstein's presentation of it was quite brief, and may have given the impression that he was confused about the nature of probability. Bohr, in particular, seems to have misunderstood Einstein rather badly. You recalled later that Einstein had doubts about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and introduced his thought experiment because he was looking for ways around it. Einstein's concerns about locality went unheard for the rest of the solar